Welcome to That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by Scientific Triathlon and hosted by me, Michael Eriksson. And today I'm joined once again by Jack Hutchins. Jack, welcome back, and how are you doing?
Thank you very much for having me, Michael. Yeah, all good. Had a decent day of training, had some calls with some athletes, just got back on the bike, and yeah, had a run this morning, so the legs are a bit fatigued, but it was nice to get out there in the sun. So yeah, how are you doing? How's your day going?
Yeah, my day has been good. It's been pretty moderately busy, lots of mainly with work, but I had a nice run, 16-kilometer run, just nice sort of steady zone one, zone two. And then I've been preparing this podcast a bit. I've had plenty of calls. I've had some parenting duties. And I told you that we had a bit of a challenge getting the baby to sleep, but he's down now, so we're recording quite late. But yeah, it's been a good day overall. About your training, since we last spoke or since we last recorded, do you have some highlight sessions, some sessions that went really well that you could share with the listeners?
Stuff that went well, I had a good bike session yesterday, actually just feeling very comfortable, just below LT2. So I managed to accumulate a decent amount of volume at that intensity. And that's kind of on the opposite end to the swim, which has been going very badly. Just seemed to be going through a bit of a bad patch at the moment in the pool. Yeah, so hopefully I'll come out of that soon. I've made a couple of changes to the stroke, and yeah, it's just always one step backwards with the swim, two steps forwards. We'll get there. Early season, so I'm enjoying getting some good progress at the moment.
And is there something that we've been talking about in the last couple of episodes that are prominent in the way that you're training now that the listeners would recognize if they had a look at your training program?
I guess one of the overriding messages we've been getting across is around intensity control and not going too crazy with intensity too early in the base phase. And that's definitely something that I've been monitoring quite closely. I do some lactate testing just to keep an eye on that, and also just in general, if you're just err on the side of caution with a lot of these sessions when the volumes is coming up and I'm off the back of a bit of a break and less training volume. So yeah, that's definitely my approach with myself and with my athletes as well this time of year.
Very good. All right, so let's not waste too much more time on our own training because we have lots of things to get through here with today's topic, cycling during the base training phase or during the off-season. Let's start with the listener questions today. For the listeners, you can follow Scientific Triathlon HQ. That's where I put out the requests for questions, and I did so today, and we got a bunch of them. I was thinking we'll do them rapid fire, so we each take turns to ask each other a question, and then we'll try to answer every question in 30 seconds or less. So I'm ready to start if you want to ask me the first question, Jack. And I have a stopwatch here in front of me, so let's go.
Okay, first one's from Zim035. How to assess power profile to improve weaknesses? How do you identify the limiters?
Yeah, so I mean, the best way, we will get to this in a later episode on testing during the base phase, but critical power testing, do something like a five minute test, a 3 minute test, a 6 minute test, and a 20 minute test is something that I like to do, or 3, 5, 20, could be 3, 6, 12. You can calculate the critical power and the W prime. You can see based on the W prime, essentially, how anaerobic you are or are not. And then you can compare that to your race goals and assess whether you need more or less of that more anaerobic type of training. I was a little bit over there, but 35 seconds. So I'll ask you the next question, which is from Setterberg FR. So I think it's Fredrik Setterberg, if I recall correctly. He's asking to ride on time trial bike or on the road bike. And we'll interpret this as during the base training phase. I activate my glutes more when on the road bike and on the trainer.
Yeah, so I think it's a good, in the base phase in general, we want to be using different bikes. The time trial bike is going to be the main bike for leading into races. So using the road bike to just generally push more power in some sessions can then translate nicely onto the TT bike. Also, you know, it allows you to explore a bit more, you can maybe use some rougher roads and get out with the groups as well. So I'd say, yeah, probably more on the road bike, but also leave the TT bike on the trainer. Was that 30 seconds?
It was a little bit more, but I actually didn't reset. So I don't know, maybe 40, 40, 45. It was pretty good. Pretty good for the first one.
So the next one's from Benny Thompson. How often would you do low cadence work? Weekly? More than once a week?
Well, I think there are periods when I would do it weekly. Maybe not so much more than once per week, although that happens, but definitely periods that I would do it once per week, but it's not something that would be necessarily weekly throughout an entire November through March time period, because there's just also a lot of other things that I think are important to get in. But there are periods within there, you could have three-week blocks or four-week blocks where you do it weekly. The next one is from cube.b0t, who asks, sweet spot versus zone 2 for base building?
I'd prioritize zone 2, but I think we would be using both. So zone 2 is probably going to make up the bulk of the volume, which is, to be honest, that's usually the case across the whole year, not just the base phase. But yeah, sweet spot as well is a great tool and zone to be using across the base phase. So yeah. I guess that didn't really answer the question, but yeah.
Prioritize zone 2, but include sweet spot. So yeah, both, but more focus on one than the other. I think that's a fair answer. Yeah. Your turn.
Yep. So the next one is from Alexis Papakonstantinio 005. It's a cool name. What to focus on as an under 23 triathlete if the goal is development, VO2, strength question mark. I think it's just two ideas he's given.
Yeah. Well, I think that's an under 23. I think that's the age. Well, from, let's say, between going after juniors, going into under 23, like that's when like ramping up volume really is the main priority in my mind. So what your intensity is focused on, that depends more on the individual characteristics, but I think more of a general blanket statement that I would say from when you go from junior to under 23 would be increased volume, and that would be not just base training but in general. I'm curious to hear your thoughts on that, Jack, because you also are quite involved with British Triathlon, so you probably have some insights from there.
Yeah, I think the volume would naturally increase a little bit, but I mean, you look at the Norwegian program and they are really pushing volume from a high age over intensity, so actually then the intensity is probably coming in more later, and that's maybe seen more in other sports as well. So yeah, I think overall you're just progressing everything really, but maybe more so race specificity and those kind of more extensive sessions.
I think the extensive sessions is a good shout as well. Yeah. Then we have two questions. I can ask you, well, I'll ask you one of these questions, actually. There are two questions from one person. Lou1sran5 asks, how hard should the hard sessions be? I think you've already answered this in the very beginning of this episode, actually.
Well, yeah, I mean, that would be in reference to the more classic kind of threshold type work. But I also would say that you want hard sessions in there, and hard as in very hard, maybe some sprint work, which we might go into later on the bike, but that's a cross swim bike run. So that's going to be some maximum efforts in that instance. And also, if we're doing some more VO2 max blocks, then we want to get the right stimulus. So those sessions need to be hard. It depends on the session, basically, for that one.
Yeah, I'll give my two cents there. I generally would advise a VO2 max session should be a session RP of around 9, 8.5, 9, a threshold session about 7, 7, 7.5 session RP. And so, yeah, the VO2 max session is certainly hard, but not quite all out, from my perspective at least.
Yeah, and sprint sessions?
Sprint sessions, I think, I think that really...
If you're doing like neuromuscular kind of efforts, right?
I think they are so hard because it depends on the athlete phenotype. So a lot of triathletes, especially age groupers, that don't really have the capacity, and I would include myself there, that to generate high power. Yeah, you're working maximally, but actually the session RP ends up being pretty low because you're just not able to go deep. Whereas if you're more of a glycolytic athlete, then you can go really, really deep. And yeah, it would be maximal. It would be a 10. So I find you push yourself maximally, but at the same time, I don't find they're maximally, depending on the duration, ends up feeling different depending on your athlete phenotype, I would say.
I guess it. I would almost then question the fatigue and preparation going in if you can't access that sort of stimulus. And then I guess it maybe also is a bit different on the swim versus the bike, for example. I feel like most people could probably push 10. Maybe it's relative 9 to 10. But yeah, there's definitely is that nuance there, I agree.
Yeah, I mean, this is an anecdote that I remember from a seminar with Dan Lorang. He came here to Portugal to have a seminar for a lot of Portuguese triathlon coaches. And he told a story about when he was with the German Federation, and this was in the time of a pretty young Jan Frodeno. I don't think he wasn't Jan Frodeno's coach at that time, but he was just a Federation coach. And Jan and I think three other German athletes, and I don't remember who they were doing some kind of sprint session, I think 20 to 30 second sprints on the bike. And he used that as an example of, after a few of those sprints, two of the athletes were basically laying on the side of the road throwing up, and two of them looked like nothing had happened. And that was his description of, or his illustration of, different athlete profiles and how the same workout can hit people super very differently. So yeah, while you're still working maximally, I do believe that there is definitely like individual characteristics within the athlete that makes it impossible to push yourself or to feel the same thing, because you just it just feels different when your maximum lactate is 8 versus 18.
No, I definitely agree with the response there, but do you think that actually during the effort they were experiencing different sensations, or that different sensations?
Yeah, maybe not so much during. It might be more of a I think to some extent during, but yeah, I mean, I know what you mean. If I do a maximum 20 second sprint on a bike, it is it is brutal, but it's like it's something that passes very quickly, and then so I think it's more pronounced probably after the reaction after.
Yeah, no, I agree with that.
Right, I think it's your turn to ask the question.
So same person has asked how to periodize volume and intensity.
Well, I think that's what we're discussing in this whole series a bit, but I think, well, the gist of it is really that we talked about this in the first base training series one, about doing things that are less race specific further away from races, so during the base phase. But that being said, if you can get in volume during the base phase, that is never a bad thing. So that I would say is something that could be a constant, and then intensity depends on more factors. I can't give a more specific answer than that into this question. Arthur Tur Caron asks, should I do training outside if the weather allows it? And if yes, for how long?
100%. Yeah, we definitely want to be getting out as much as possible. I mean, we'll talk about this today, but yeah, bike handling skills, it just makes it a little bit more palatable than sitting on the trainer. You can usually, not always, but with some session types, you can get a better execution of the session as well. So yeah, easy answer for me for that one.
Yeah.
So the next one is from Clemen Soligo J. Dry. Apologies for that pronunciation. How do I get my FTP from 300 to 350 watts?
Yeah.
LOL.
This was actually the only question I really looked at. It stood out before, so the other ones are more or less a new off the cuff. I think you have two options here. If you're still kind of 40 or younger, you could quit your job and start training full time and get a really good coach and do that for full focus for 2, 3, 4 years. That could work. The other one is to change your parents, but it might be too late to do that.
Yeah, just easy one, that one.
Yeah, yeah. There is a third answer, I guess, but then you're not allowed to do any verifications or anything. So
I'm still... 50 watts is a lot.
50 watts would still be a lot, yeah. Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Okay. We need to thank our sponsors, Transition Fuel and Hydration. So I want to ask you a question about how you use their products. Basically, what is your strategy for using electrolytes during races?
So I've done a sweat test with Transition Fuel and Hydration, which I do recommend everyone does if they get the chance. And I'm a very salty sweater. So I'm up at 1,250 milligrams per liter of sweat. So it's a high sodium, sorry. So it's a high sodium concentration. And in order to tackle that, I am preloading day before and morning of with the pH 1500 sachets in my water or drink mix. And then during the bike, I'm kind of overdoing. I'm aiming for about 1500 milligrams of sodium per liter, with the knowing that on the run, I'm probably not going to be able to take in quite as much sodium because I'm taking stuff on course. That being said, I do take quite a highly concentrated sodium drink out of T2 with me that I've pre-prepared. And then on the run, you kind of just make and do with what's on course. But that's usually does me pretty well.
Have you ever estimated how much roughly of the sodium that you lose that you would replace in terms of percentage?
Probably have done at some point, but not for a few years. So I can't give you a number, I'm afraid.
All right. Yeah. And one final question on this. How do you, what do you do with, when you coach athletes, what do you recommend in terms of sodium? Do you recommend doing some kind of testing to figure out, or is it more trial and error to see what works for them?
Yeah, I mean, the gold standard is doing the sweat testing, right? Even though it does change a little bit, and you can, I think there's a bit more research coming out now saying that it is quite trainable, or not quite trainable, but it can change with the adaptation and training a bit. So if they can't do that, then it's again going with the preloading, with the sodium preloading. So they're always going in well hydrated and with a good electrolyte status. And then it's practicing in race simulation sessions a moderate kind of amount of sodium, see how they fare. If they're getting excessive or cramping or any other kind of symptoms of dehydration, then it's adjusting and going and seeing if we can get it right, basically. So testing is the main answer, but those are the kind of approaches that I would take with my athletes.
Yeah,
what about you?
Yeah, I exactly the same. I also think as a great starting point, I do use the online sweat test on precisionfuelhydration.com. Mm. I think that it does an amazing job of getting an athlete to understand whether they're low compared to a high volume sweater. It's not going to put you in the wrong category, put you in the low category if you are actually in the high category. You might get a bit put in the medium if you are in the high in reality, but then the differences are not so big that you can't overcome that with a little bit of experimenting in training. So I think that's also a starting point that I use, the online sweat test. So, listeners, you can use the code TTS2025 on precisionfuelhydration.com to get 15% off your first order of 2025. So do go and use that. And they also have gels and carbohydrate products. All right. Now let's move on to our discussion about cycling during the off season or during the base training phase. First question from me to you, Jack, is how do you approach volume? And because that's what we've heard. Yeah, the winter, that's when you go out and accumulate miles, winter miles, summer miles, all of that. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that maximizing volume is one of the main goals of the base phase. But the caveat for me is that it's the maximum sustainable volume that we're aiming for. So yes, in theory, you could do 20 hours a week off the bat, but you're not going to probably recover from that over the whole winter. And that's also just going to take too much of a toll. So especially if you're applying, we're training for an Ironman, then the base phase is most likely not where you would see the highest volume. So typically, I would say that we are building the volume relatively quickly to the maximum sustainable, or getting quite close to the maximum sustainable volume early in the base phase. And then we perhaps build more gradually. But if you, and what you quite often see is you've already hit your time budget for the week. So then it would just be a case of maintaining that volume in terms of duration, and then the progression might come from other ways. And typically we might also see a drop in volume as we kind of do a VO2 max block. And what my typical approach is that we would have that initial phase where we're really progressing and aerobic development and volume is the focus. And then once we get, tends to be, you know, 12 weeks or so out from the first race of the season, we would do a VO2 max block, and then we're doing a bit of a reverse periodization approach where the volume goes down initially and then it would increase again into that race specific block. But I guess that's still being that VO2 max block and maybe threshold block is still included in the base phase there. Do you take a similar approach?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, I think you're right there with what you're saying, that you can, for most athletes, at least when you've been in the sport for, let's say, a couple of years or more, it's pretty easy to quickly ramp up to your maximum sustainable volume, because most of us are not limited by our physical capacity to do the volume, but by our time budget simply. So it's not really that hard to get there. So I'm the same there, really building up to that maximum sustainable volume pretty quickly, and then doing that after your season break without doing too much in terms of intensity. Definitely some intensity, but light versions of the intense sessions and some of the skills and stuff that we have talked about already and we will talk more about. And then when you hit that maximum sustainable volume, you consolidate it a bit over a couple of weeks, and then you can start to build up a bit more the load that comes from the intensity side of things. And I also agree with, when you do some of the really intense training, like a VO2 max block, then I would lower the volume. But the difference is that I would probably do that kind of irrespective of when the first race falls. I would try to work it in a bit earlier and maybe try to fit in two of those blocks, let's say 2 week blocks during the whole base training phase. So it might be, if somebody started their base training in the beginning of November, let's say, then they might do a VO2 max block already just before Christmas, leading into Christmas, and then a second one in February or something, or March, early March. So it might, well, Christmas, maybe a bit early, but maybe early January, and then again, late February or early March, something like that. So that would be maybe the difference to what you said.
I really like what you said about the light versions of the intense sessions there, and that's definitely an approach I take. We have kind of all the ingredients that we would at kind of peak training load, but we're being a lot more controlled about it. We're really looking to stay consistent with them. What does that look like for you practically speaking, say on just a kind of classic week in the middle of a base phase?
Yeah, so I was prepared enough that I opened Training Peaks and looking at, have an athlete's program that just restarted training. So an example there is that he's doing, or did this week, 6x4 minutes threshold on the bike. And this athlete would, when he's in full race season, or when he's built up fully that intensity, that would be more like a 10x4 minutes, even 12x4 minutes potentially. So we're at 50 to 60% of the total volume of intensity. The power itself, I lowered the target a little bit compared to in-season threshold, just on account of having had a two-week break, but that was more like a maximum of 5 to 10 watts lower than normal. So it's very similar. Yeah, I think it was only 5 watts, to be fair. So very similar power, but just doing less volume. And that would be the same pretty much regardless of what type of session we're talking about, just reducing the volume. But secondly, also, it could be reducing the interval duration. So this same athlete, he might also be doing sessions like 5x8 minutes in season. But now in this early phase of the off season or base training phase, he would be doing 8 minute intervals. It'd be 4 minute intervals for threshold work.
Are you typically going right kind of in terms of right towards LT2, or are you keeping it more kind of sweet spot for that type of session.
That was right. That was right towards LT2. Yeah. So I'm. Yeah. That I don't really. Yeah. I don't see too much of a problem with doing that. In fact, I think that maybe that can be an advantage because you can get a bit of a you can get a decent stimulus with relatively low volume. Whereas if I guess the temptation is if you do sweet spot is that you do maybe you could still of course follow the same principles and just do a 50-60% version of it, but yeah, I don't think that the intensity itself is something that I'm concerned with really. It's more it's the load overall, which is the volume, the intensity and the volume at intensity really. So yeah, I could see myself doing sweet spot as well. In this case I didn't, and it's not something that I have as a philosophy or a general approach that I always build up to LT2. I'm happy to sometimes go straight to LT2, but there are athletes. I would say that this depends a bit on the athlete phenotype. So an athlete that is more of a slow twitch dominant athlete, I'm very happy to go straight to LT2. An athlete that is more fast twitch dominant, I might be a bit careful because I don't want to overshoot, and that's where I would probably consider doing some tempo sweet spot work instead of going straight to LT2 because also the cost of doing a bit too much is higher for those fast twitch dominant athletes.
Yeah, no, I agree. And do you do any strength in there around that intensity or in terms of any torque, high torque, low cadence stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. Around those intensities, threshold or LT2 and sweet spot, I think I've gravitated more recently to going a bit higher, and I'm not fully convinced that there's too much of a difference, to be honest, whether you do a bit more work at sweet spot or a bit less work at LT2, or even I've done more recently as well with above LT2, but short, let's say 1 to 4 minute reps at more of a 105-110% threshold type of intensity. So I haven't seen too much of a difference. So I think that there's probably something to be said for mixing things up a little bit with the torque work, but definitely torque work in some shape or form is always part of the base training. Not right from the beginning necessarily, but it will come in pretty quickly. What about you and the sessions that you tend to be doing?
Yeah, no, I agree with there's a lot of parallels there. I quite like using some shorter reps closer to LT2 at kind of lower cadences just to get that peripheral stimulus and that kind of strength element. And then almost backing it up with some longer reps that are a bit more strictly below LT2. So I guess that's maybe where we differ ever so slightly is that I would be a little bit more cautious with intensity control on those threshold stuff, just because I know, especially earlier in the base phase, how easy it is for people to overdo it. And yeah, I mean, it's for me, I'd rather do a little bit more and maybe undercook it rather than a little bit higher power.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think other than that, we're on the same page there.
It's good that we don't agree on everything. I think that that's pretty boring listening, and also not super useful for us if we always agree on everything from the perspective of learning. So happy to hear that. What about we talked when we had the swimming episode last week? We talked a lot about the skills and how we develop skills and focus on that. Is that something that you put a lot of emphasis on the bike as well? And if so, how?
When you define skills, are you defining kind of bike
it's very
handling
broad.
Type skills?
Yeah, okay. Very super broad. Everything from bike handling to neuromuscular proficiency, I guess. And yeah.
I mean, actually, this kind of because for the neuromuscular development stuff, you obviously want the physiological stress to be quite low, right? There's for obvious reasons, we need if you want to access and get the response from those types of skills, say sprints and that kind of high cadence spin ups and that kind of stuff, we want the load to be low. So that's why it's typically nice to do it relatively early, where the threshold work has not progressed to being that substantial. and that's when I would typically use it. And yeah, I do like to have some single leg drills in there, some spin ups where we're really going to 20 to 30 RPM above what they're comfortable or what their kind of normal cadence would be at. And then also some sprints as well, where typically I would just be prescribing 10 seconds kind of all out. So we're not getting that massive lactate production, but we're still getting that really high output over those shorter durations. And yeah, I mean, we also, sorry, do you want to go?
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about the sprints. Do you ever have a situation where you have an athlete that you actually want them, you want to increase their ability to produce lactate or produce energy glycolytically? And if so, would you change those sprints? Would you make them longer?
Yeah, it's funny you say that, because actually I do have an athlete who I'm doing that with currently in the pool. But it's, I would still use both with the same athlete probably, and the lactate production stuff would maybe come a little bit later. This is more of a kind of still early season, and we're really looking at efficiency and that sort of focus. And then later on, I'd add more of a pure lactate production session, which, yeah, where we would be looking at more like 30 seconds to 30 to 45, maybe even 60 second reps. Yeah. I also think just in general, when you're doing a lot of aerobic volume and you want to keep the intensity quite low and you don't want to be throwing in a load of threshold sessions, it breaks it up, right? It becomes a little bit more palatable to sit on the turbo in the winter rather than just doing, you know, 90 minutes at zone 1 to 2. Actually, if you can throw in some single leg, some drills and that kind of stuff, it definitely makes things a bit easier. Do you use that sort of stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. I use sprints similar to you, 10 seconds. I might go to 15 seconds for, again, but only for more like, it's really only on the bike, to be fair, in the pool as well. On the run, I would always stick to strictly 10 seconds maximum, but on the bike, sometimes it's 15 seconds, but I would again be much more restrictive if it's somebody who's more fast switch dominant and being more okay with it being going to 15 if it's more of a slow twitch dominant athlete. And you mentioned spin ups. Yeah, I have a session that probably every single one of my athletes that listening to this will recognize, which is basically 10 minute intervals. It's actually not my session. I'll credit it to David Tilbury Davis, who used it a lot when I was working with him. And it's 4 minutes, 3 minutes, 2 minutes, 1 minute. And I usually would start it at 90, the 4 minutes is at, it's all kind of low zone two, low to mid zone two, and the 4 minutes at 95 RPM, 3 minutes at 100, then 2 minutes at 105, and 1 minute at 110. Or depending on how proficient the athlete is at higher cadences, you might start at 5 RPMs higher or lower, even in some cases, if the athlete is really struggling with that. So the baseline can adjust a little bit, but that's the gist of the session, and do that maybe four to five times. So it's 45 times 10 minutes with a 3 to 5 minutes rest in between. That's a favorite of mine for the high cadence work. And we talked about the low cadence already, which to me also is a large part of the benefit of that is the neuromuscular benefits and neuromuscular development. So yeah, sprints, low cadence, high cadence. I don't really do any other drills, like you mentioned, single leg drills. I have used that in the past. I kind of got away from it. And so, yeah, I think that covers it with that neuromuscular stuff. And then maybe if you talk about bike handling, actually one of the things that I think is probably the best way is not accessible to everybody, but if you have a mountain bike, if you can go out and ride your mountain bike or even like a gravel bike, I think that just mixing it up with the bikes and the terrain you're riding on, that can be a great way to work on bike handling and skills in that way. So that's something that I encourage. And yeah, that's mainly for the bike handling, really. It's the mixing up bikes. But as you said, getting out as much as possible, especially if you have those longer endurance rides that you might have, or any endurance rides, whether it be long or short, still trying to get out if it's possible, depending on your climate. So you're kind of always training that in a way every time you get out. Is there anything else from your side on the bike handling?
No, yeah. If you can get the confidence on the road bike, riding in wet, dark conditions, then it's going to bode well, right, coming into the season on the TT bike.
Yeah, for sure. I wouldn't know about that. I never ride in the dark. Do you do that?
I mean, when I say dark, I just mean UK, the UK version of a winter, which is just always just a bit grey. And yeah. Although saying that, the other day I did ride in the dark. Not my whole ride, but I had 4-5 hours or something, and it gets dark at like 6 p.m. So I headed out a little bit late, and the last half hour was an hour or so was pretty dark. But I had lights in preparation for that. So
No, I agree with that, and I think that.
And you're from Finland, right? You must
It's just not possible to ride outside there for 5-6 months of the year, and I'm being generous if I give it 5 months. At least that was the case. But I moved. Yeah, I've been out of Finland for 8 years at this point. So actually, my mom, who is also doing triathlon, started more recently. But she's been doing it for quite a few years now. She was actually out riding just this past weekend, which would have been the 16th of November, which was unheard of when I was still in Finland. That never happened. Like, October was the latest point that I would ever go out riding. That was a stretch, really. So times are changing. The climate is changing, but I mean, you have to, I guess a way of making lemonade to use that to ride outside more when you're in Finland.
No, that's kind of scary, to be fair, the changing climate.
I was gonna say, one way as well that I think helps people, especially if you're like a bit concerned about the wet, maybe the roads are a little bit slippery, if not with ice, because that can be really dangerous, but let's say fallen leaves and stuff like that, when they get wet, it can be a bit sketchy. I would say a lot of people in the UK I know have just a winter bike, or a completely separate bike for all the dirt and stuff. But even if you don't have that, just put on the slow stuff on your bike. So, you know, shallow wheels, shallow aluminium wheels, slow tires, something like gator skins or something like that. All of the things. And you wear obviously some warmer clothes. You don't need to care if they're aero or not. Just anything that slows you down can help in building that confidence when the conditions aren't the best. So that, I think, is something to consider if you're, I guess, struggling to get going with the outdoor riding when it's continuously wet outside and wet and a bit sketchy to ride.
Yeah, I'd also add to that, if you can get a handlebar bag or something and put a spare jacket, because even when it's forecast to be not too bad, if you get caught in rain or something on the bike, if the temperature's pretty cold, then it quickly becomes unbearable, right? So yeah, that's a good hack that I've kind of come up with in the last couple of winters.
Yeah. What about we touched on it already with the different bikes, but let's say if you have somebody who really is mainly riding indoors during the winter, mainly on the trainer, how would you then think about the use of road bike versus TT bike?
Say again, sorry, they had a TT bike on the trainer?
No, they had a choice of either a TT bike or a road bike, or just swapping between them on the trainer.
Yeah, I mean, you hear some people say that they use the road bike to build the power and then they transfer it to the TT bike, which I'm not 100% sold on that kind of thing. But I think if you feel like you can push a lot more on the road bike, then then maybe you should take advantage of that to a certain degree. But then I also think that if you feel like you can push a lot more on the road bike, then that's probably a big limitation when it comes to getting back onto the TT bike. So you should probably be spending the winter doing more work on the TT bike in order to specifically condition for riding on that tight position, right? But yeah, I would say if there's not much of a discrepancy there, then you can kind of do either and mix it up. I'm not particularly you know, sold on one way or the other. I know you have top guys who barely ever use the TT bike until, you know, the last few weeks before racing, and then you have others who ride the TT bike all year round. I don't think there's one set way, but it's unless there is a big limitation. Do you agree?
Yeah, I would agree with that. Basically, if there's a big discrepancy, I would definitely emphasize the TT bike more, especially for the harder sessions. That said, when my general rule of thumb is that whenever we're going above LT2, whether you're on the TT bike or not doesn't matter, but sit up in the base bar, because when you're above LT2, typically for me, the goal would be to maximize the output, the power output. So, and it's less about the specifics of the position. But I mean, that's not the majority of training, of course. So yeah, I agree with that. And when you're on the turbo, on the indoor trainer, what are some, you have spent a lot of time on the turbo as well in your days. So what are some tips to make the most out of that time from one side, just in terms of the training structure, or just, yeah, is there any differences when you're on the turbo compared to when you're riding outdoors? And secondly, just to make it a bit more entertaining, a bit more fun for people that might struggle with that.
Yeah, I mean, one thing is just accepting that it's tough, right? And just getting on it, and not maybe, if you've got a long ride still on the trainer, don't overthink it. Just get on, start pedaling, and then, you know, you'll get through it eventually. I also sometimes like to just break it up, as if you're going for a long ride and you might stop at a cafe halfway around. I think there's no problem doing that on the trainer. Stop for 10 minutes in the middle, grab a coffee, have a little break, jump back on. I also think that having all your food organized before your nutrition, the same way that you would if you're going out for a ride, and you can kind of use that to reward yourself going through the ride. Once you're more than kind of a few weeks into the base phase, or depending on the individual, but if you can cope with adding a little bit of intensity variation as well on those zone one, zone two rides. So you might go up to more upper zone two, approaching LT1 for some short periods. It doesn't have to be loads, but just having a few blocks of maybe 20 minutes here, 20 minutes there, upper zone two, we're getting a little bit extra stimulus in there. And obviously the kilojoules are going up. So you need to be mindful of that, and you need to be, you know, conditioned and ready to do that. But if you are ready, then it's a great way to make a 3-4 hour turbo ride a little bit more palatable than just sitting at X amount of watts for the whole time.
Yeah. I want to get your opinion on this, because the last couple of winters that I was riding and training, I never, you know, sat on a specific, I never used erg mode for my endurance riding. It was always using the terrain in the virtual world and basically just riding, kind of the way I would have done if it was outside, and that breaks things up a lot. I mean, I guess I shouldn't say this, because I shouldn't be getting paid for saying this, but I really love Ruvi as a platform. I would happily let them sponsor the podcast. I think that Ruvi lets you ride basically any interesting route in the world, and that was just such a fun time to just discover new places, new rides, and you could choose a long one, you could choose a bunch of short ones and mix things up, and then just ride according to the terrain, basically. So that to me was a game changer compared to Swift, which I was using for many years before that. But I don't know, I found that virtual world was, to me, a bit boring and not so engaging. So I actually found myself always watching Netflix or something else, YouTube on the side, and just collecting the points in Swift rather than actually engaging in the virtual world. But yeah, I think Ruby was made indoor riding a lot more fun for me when I started using that. But I think, yeah, to your point, varying the intensity, but of course you don't want to go overboard when you get up those big climbs, but I think that getting out of erg mode can be a good way of making things a bit less tedious when you're on the turbo.
Yeah, I need to try Ruby. I've not used it, but it sounds good. I mean, I've used Zwift, I've used the Trainer Peaks version, which is also pretty good. But yeah, for me, I typically would just stick to Netflix. Although this is a side note, but I saw that there's a Grand Theft Auto, the PlayStation
Yeah.
version. They've made a modification for that. So you can attach your trainer and you can ride around the Grand Theft Auto world,
Wow.
and this guy has made a mod for it, and you can steer the bike, and you're steering, and you have, you can literally, yeah, you can even draft the cars in Theft Auto. So I'm waiting for that to become mainstream because that looks amazing. Hopefully,
That is so cool.
I don't think anyone will want to ride outside, but yeah.
Any other things regarding indoor training? Did we cover them? Yeah, I think we covered most. Or do you have anything else to add on that?
No, I mean, to be honest, erg mode, I love erg mode. I think it's great for intensity control, and if it makes the session more palatable, I'm not really against it. I think as long as you have periods going into the race where you're getting used to pushing the power you need to push, and you're not a complete slave to it, I think it has its place. So,
Yeah, I agree. I'm not against it, and
yeah.
especially for the endurance rides. If I think it comes down to a bit preference, what makes it move. The thing is, I think a lot of people just automatically choose erg mode for their endurance rides, and but then it's boring for them. And I think a lot of people, if they tried to do it differently, more like outdoor riding, it would actually be more fun. But I don't. Of course, the training is. Not really, there's really no difference in terms of the training effectiveness. I don't think if you have, the same average power and whether you're out in or out of erg mode. So definitely not against it, but I think it can be a hack for making indoor training a bit more fun to get out of it.
Yeah, it's a good
What
point.
about virtual races? Is that something that you incorporate?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't typically do too many in the early to mid in the base season, just because it's quite an effort. If you're properly going all out and doing a race, then it's maybe going to take away from the week. But I think that they're a great thing to add in periodically, especially as you maybe get more towards midway through the base phase. Yeah, I think. But ultimately, if it's going to motivate someone to get on the bike, then I'm all for it. That's the most important thing. What about you?
Yeah, I think it can be a great motivational tool. So from that perspective, I would add them in. And also depending a bit on somebody who's training at a higher volume, I would be much more careful because, as you said, then that load is. But I have a few athletes that train at a pretty low volume, and then there's not much of a cost of making one of their or making maybe their one hard bike session a virtual race. So then I'm more. I guess more carefree with that, but in general, I take a similar approach. I think it can be really useful when you approach races, and especially if your bike is a weakness, it can be a great way to do one of your quality sessions on the bike and actually make it harder than you could push yourself in an actual session. But yeah, that's something that would. If it's something that I consciously not just put in there because it motivates the athlete, but because as a tool, as a training tool, then it would be more a bit closer to approaching the race specific training when you already have built up quite a bit of fitness. So this might be February, March or so, if we say that the race specific training might start in April or so.
Yeah, no, I agree with that.
One more thing that I wanted to ask about as well is. You mentioned, so you're tinkering with your swim stroke during this time of year a bit and see if you can optimize it. Do you do the same with your bike position in any way?
Yeah, I'm actually doing aero testing with Bernardo on Thursday, friend of the podcast, owner of Aero Edge. So if anyone needs some aerodynamic testing, Bernardo at Aero Edge is your man. So yeah, now's the time of year to make changes, really. I mean, you can do them anytime if you have to, but there's less risk at this point in so not just from a aerodynamic perspective, obviously, but biomechanically and trying to dial in. Yeah, for sure. the game is constantly evolving.
You just get so busy when you're, at least if you're racing quite a bit, it's just so busy. You're always preparing for, like, always preparing for the next race and thinking about, oh, like, what are the things that I need to do here? I need to, like, sort my travel out. I need to get this thing because this other thing broke and all of that. So in terms of just the logistics of triathlon, which is already hard enough, I think that a lot of people have more time this time of year. So that's a reason to do it. And even if it's not aero testing, just something as simple as, not simple, but something as important as getting a bike fit, if you haven't had one in a while, can also be, this is also a great time to do that, in my opinion.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Sure. Agreed.
Is it something that you do on your own, though, like try to test things on when you're riding indoors, changing your position, or are you pretty happy to have it settled and then you go and do some testing and adapt it a bit and then you keep that until you do some further testing?
Yeah, I mean, typically, to be honest, the last year or so, I've not made that many changes because I've been pretty happy with my position. I know it's fast and comfortable and I can push good power. But yeah, in the past, I've definitely been just making a small change, see how it feels for a couple of sessions, making another small change, maybe whether that just be saddle height, saddle forward and backwards. I'm not sure.
Or, you know, fore and aft?
Is it fore and aft? Is that,
I think so. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. So, yeah, so saddle fore and aft, and then front end changes, obviously, as well. And then also just, I think, obviously, aero testing, you can't replace it, but just if you want to, it's a good exercise just to get some side-on footage and front-on footage. I know a lot of the aero guys, aero experts will recommend riding in front of a mirror as well, and you can kind of just eyeball it a little bit. It definitely is not necessarily always going to work, as in what you think looks fast is not always going to be fast. But I think some people have a riding around with such obviously bad head positions and that sort of thing that it's definitely a good time to change and train your body to be able to hold a decent position in that regard.
Yeah, 100%. I think that I agree with that. I would encourage people to film themselves both from side view and frontal view. I mean, CDA is the coefficient of drag times frontal area. The frontal area is pretty easily measurable in a frontal view, so you can actually measurably, if you have some kind of standardized setup, a standardized position where you have your phone, your camera, then you can actually see even if you're making improvements in that A part of the CDA. And yeah, I think actually there are some interesting, I haven't checked it in a while, I know, and I can't even remember what it was called, but there is some interesting applications for AI in this realm where you could put a phone in front of you or on even to the side. And I think to the front was the one application I saw, and it would supposedly tell you, help you, guide you through making your positional changes and then to improve your aerodynamics. So I think I played around with it. It wasn't super mature at that point, but this is already a year and a half ago, maybe. So I might have another look at that and see where it's at. I think that that's an area where the technology is kind of probably strong. It should be easy enough to implement that with some work, or not easy, but you know, it should be doable to implement that. So I think that we might see some more applications like that in the next year or two.
What was the application called?
Gosh, I think the person is called Rob. He might be called Robbie Ketchell. I need to look it up. I can't remember what the application was called. Maybe I'll try to put it in the show notes. I'll take a note here to put it in the show notes. Free shout out for Robbie. I did have a call with him at some point, so I'll maybe reach out again and see where he's at with that work. But yeah, regardless of that, just classic old filming and making some obvious changes, I think is definitely a good time to do that at this time of year.
Yeah, for sure. Agreed.
I think we're pretty much done with this. Or do you have anything else? We probably have a surprise segment from you as well. So just to explain this, because I'm not sure if I've actually explained this in the previous episodes, the idea is that you bring a topic that I don't have. We obviously know what the cycling during the base training phase. That is our topic for today. But this is a topic that you bring that I have no idea what we're going to talk about. So that's the idea of Jack's surprise segment. So do you have a topic for me, Jack?
Yeah, so today's one is very, I want to start early on because it's typically something that's being revisited, but it's goals in general. Do we need goals? We've all heard of process versus outcome goals and how outcome goals can be damaging, but do we even need written and tangible kind of process goals and or outcome goals? How do you approach goals and goal setting?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. I think some people don't need them because they're so just intrinsically motivated just by the training process and just general improvement, perhaps. That, well, I guess improvement is still a goal in a way, but it's not something specific. But for a lot of people, I do think goals are very useful because it brings motivation, it brings some structure and direction. So it isn't even necessarily that you'll be demotivated without goals, but you may be overwhelmed because you don't even know what to do because you don't actually know what is important to you and what you want to achieve. Do you want to win a sprint distance triathlon or do you want to win an Ironman? Those are two completely different goals and require quite different directions in terms of training. So goals can bring a lot of clarity into what you're doing and reduce overwhelm and stress. So there are many reasons to have goals and outcome goals. I definitely think that you shouldn't only have outcome goals. You should also have process goals. I don't think that you can't have outcome goals. I think you can have that. But then you also, basically how I approach it is to try to, okay, if my outcome goal is that I want to do certain time in a certain race, then break that down into what does that mean? And in terms of, let's say, your swim, bike, and run, what does that mean in terms of the threshold power, threshold paces that I need? And what does that mean in terms of the training that I need to do? This is, of course, a hypothesis because you cannot predict that with certainty, but that can then help you create the process goals that becomes what you focus on in the day-to-day. So this could be, for example, well, we know that your swim is just probably limiting you from actually achieving your outcome goal, but you've only been swimming twice a week for the last 5 years. Let's up the swimming to 3 times a week and let's also increase the distance of those swims. That's a process goal that we think is necessary for you to achieve your outcome goal. So I think you can take an outcome goal and you can reverse engineer the process goals from there. So that's, and how I approach it in practical terms, well, I mentioned this, I think, in another episode that this is the time of year when we do some season review and season planning. And I just ask the athletes in the planning, it's basically a form, a Google form with a lot of questions. But one of the questions is, or two of the questions are, what are your outcome goals for next year? And what are your process goals for next year? So I ask the athletes to come up with them and then we discuss them and we might alter them if there's a need to do that. But oftentimes they're quite good off the bat. So that's, yeah, the goals. At least to some extent, they should come from the athlete because then that's what helps them stay motivated and that's what makes them have full buy-in into the goal and really benefit from the motivation that it brings. But then maybe there are some tweaks that need to be made. I obviously need to sign off on whether I think it's realistic or not. Or sometimes if I think it's just too easy, which I also said that, well, that goal is too easy. It's not going to be hard for you to achieve that. A good outcome goal, I think you achieve maybe 50% of the time or so. You shouldn't know that you can achieve it.
Good answer. Yeah, covered. Yeah, no, I'm impressed. I think, there's not much more I would add, really.
Maybe one thing that could be interesting here to round off this episode, actually, is if we talk about whether we have any outcome and process goals that we're working towards. So do you have any off the top of your head?
No, I mean, outcome goals. I mean, not really. No, none that I'm thinking about. I mean, if you gave me 5-10 minutes, I probably have some. But yeah, for me, it's just about executing and getting, in terms of as an athlete, it's about executing the training as best I can every day. And it's not any more complicated than that, really. What about you?
Yeah. So as I've mentioned in previous episodes, I'm on a bit of a hiatus from doing triathlon myself. I'm doing trail running at the moment. So my outcome goal is not necessarily so specific, but I have a couple of 50K races that I'm doing next year, 50Ks in the mountains. And basically my outcome goal is that I want to be able to feel like I'm like actually running those races to the finish, that I'm not breaking down, which I have done in the previous races of that distance, and feeling that I have the energy, I have the capacity cardiovascularly and metabolically, but my body just can't do it. So that's my goal, basically, to be able to run properly until the end of those races. And my process goal accordingly is reverse engineered from that. So it's a lot, it's about building up my muscular endurance, and so that it includes both hill reps outdoors and on the treadmill, because I don't have any long hills here, so I do longer hill reps on the treadmill. And it includes gym work, specific muscular endurance work that I actually never did as a triathlete, because I don't think it would have been specific or good type of gym work from a triathlon perspective. So these would be things like, to give you an idea, 6 sets of 10 reps of step-ups with 1 minute rest, followed by 6 sets of 10 reps of lunges with 1 minute rest, and a couple of other exercises like that. So it's kind of relatively short rest. It's definitely high volume. And so it's not that type of build your maximum force strength training that most triathletes are doing, and that makes more sense from a triathlon perspective, or running for that matter. But it really is about building resilience and robustness in the muscles. So that's the other process goal, to try to do that regularly. And to be honest, it's been 2 weeks since I've done a gym session, because I've been a bit struggling for time. So I feel a bit bad about that now, but I'll get back on it this week, I promise.
It's a good goal. And I can see your process there. It'd be good to follow along.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's it. Maybe I won't record a separate outro, so I'll just give a bit of some final housekeeping items. So remember that Precision Fuel Hydration have a discount code TTS2025 that will give you 15% off your first order of 2025 on your electrolytes and carbohydrates. Also, remember that at Scientific Triathlon, we have coaching, we have training plans, customized training plans and consultations. So check out scientifictriathlon.com if what we're talking about here, I guess, if it resonates with you, if you think that the type of coaching we offer sounds like something that you could benefit from, don't hesitate to email. You can find contact information in the episode description. And now is as good a time as any, if not better, to start working with a coach. So we would recommend that, of course. And we'll be back with another episode. I actually have a really exciting interview that I'm probably doing this Thursday. So, and I just found out. So I'll see, either I might release 2 episodes next week, or we might take a 1 week break from the base training series. Let's see about that, depending on how things work out with time commitments and so on. But there'll definitely be some, we'll be back soon enough, Jack and I, and there'll also be some other content, at least one really exciting interview with an exciting guest. And that's pretty much it. So thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.